Hello, this is Lincoln, reading for you the Iroquois County Times-Republic for Thursday, April 23rd, 2026. At the top of the front page, tornadoes confirmed in Iroquois County from April 17th storm, by Carla Waters, managing editor. Two tornadoes have been confirmed in Iroquois County from a line of storms that caused damage and power outages from around the region April 17th. Iroquois County Emergency Management Agency Director Scott Anderson said in press releases that tornadoes had been confirmed in Buckley and Milford. Anderson said his agency has been working with the Chicago office of the National Weather Service. No injuries were reported with any of the weather-related incidents. Earlier Friday afternoon, a damaging line of storms was identified, and the National Weather Service issued a tornado watch for Iroquois County at 3:31 p.m. that would expire at 11 p.m. Late Friday night, a severe squall line capable of producing both tornadoes and damaging straight-line winds was headed for all areas within Iroquois County, and this prompted the National Weather Service to issue a severe thunderstorm warning for the western half of the county at 9:05 p.m. As this line continued to move east, there were significant areas of embedded circulation identified, and the NWS issued a tornado warning at 9:15 p.m. for the western half of the county. This was significantly earlier than the storm was due to pass into the area, but the NWS decided to issue the warning at that time to prepare the residents and to keep them informed. The sirens were sounded by ICOM dispatch in the western half of the county per EMA protocol at the time of the warning. This combination was to make sure residents were aware of the approaching dangerous situation. As the line began to pass through the county, the NWS issued a severe thunderstorm warning for the eastern half of the county at 9:46 p.m. No tornado warning was issued by the National Weather Service for the eastern half of the county, he said, noting that as the severe winds hit Watsika, he ordered that the sirens should be sounded for Watsika and the eastern half of the county. Due to the very rapid eastward pace of the line of winds, along with the time it takes the ICOM to dispatch center to activate all the sirens on the eastern half, the Watsika sirens sounded just after the severe winds passed through. The sounding of the sirens on the east side of the county were not only for the line of severe wind, but they were for what very easily could have been for an embedded tornado within the front as it passed through, he said. Significant damage within the county was reported, and the NWS confirmed that an EF1 rated tornado was responsible for the destruction in the Buckley area. Members of the Paxton ERS assisted EMA with spotting duties as well as damage assessment in the Buckley area. Heavy damage was also reported in Woodland, with outbuildings, trees, and power poles knocked down or destroyed. For the second time in a year, the Nauth family at Nauth Farm in Milford suffered significant damage to their cattle, buildings, and trees, but no animals were harmed. The city of Watsika had a concentrated area of major tree damage, all on the southeast quadrant of the city. The severe line exited the county and continued its path of damage into Kentland, Indiana. Other areas of damage within the county may be reported later, he said. More information was released on April 20th about the tornado at Milford. After further review of data and site visits by the damage assessment team from the NWS, the damage that was surveyed at the Nauth Farm outside of Milford has been designated as a tornado, and as the path continued east into Darrow, the tornado sheared fairly new power poles off at the base just south of U.S. Highway 24 near Effner at the Newton County, Indiana line. The strength of the wind required to fell the poles in that way earned the tornado an EF2 rating. The tornado continued into Newton County, Anderson said. He said as more information is received and analyzed, along with assessments being made in person, there could be other areas where damage was done that could be designated as a tornado. Lynn Strong presents The Immigrant Experience, A Suitcase Full of Hope, by Kim Rabe for the Times Republic. Lynn Strong, president of Ostfriesen Geological Society, Genealogical Society of America, presented The Immigrant Experience, A Suitcase Full of Hope, via Zoom on Saturday, April 11th, at Schwer Church, rural Milford. The program was hosted by Iroquois County Genealogical Society. Those who helped with the meal and program were Eileen Burns, president of ICGS, Jennifer Hendry, vice president of ICGS, Dee Eckersley, Mary Burr, recording secretary of ICGS, Kathy Grazis, ICGS corresponding secretary, and Pastor Fresh, who assisted with the video presentation. Information on OGSA can be found by visiting www.ogsa.us. The organization publishes quarterly journals which are packed with history, culture, and customs. This year, a three-day conference will take place July 23rd through 25th in Mendota Heights, Minnesota. More information about that event can be found on the website. Emigrant refers to someone leaving their home country, and immigrant refers to someone entering a new country. Therefore, the term generally refers to the same person. 1900 emigration trends. The majority of emigrants entering the U.S. came for farmland, even though many did settle in the cities. The major reasons for emigration were famine and severe economic conditions. Between 1900 and 1909, over 1 million emigrants left Austria-Hungary, and 1.5 million left Russia. During the last part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, about 4 million came from British Isles. Spain and Portugal experienced a high rate of emigration, with most going to Argentina and Brazil. By the late 19th century, there was still a large number of emigrants from Germany, with some going to the Netherlands, but most going to the U.S. Large numbers of emigrants left Sweden for the U.S. between 1869 and 1900. Norway had the highest proportion of its population emigrate during this time, and Denmark saw roughly 800,000 emigrants during the same time period, with most going to the U.S. Scandinavian immigration between 1869 and 1900 because of the famine and economic conditions. About 800,000 Swedes left for the U.S. Going into 1900, Sweden continued to see large numbers of emigrants leave, with most headed for the U.S. During this time period, Norway and Denmark saw large numbers of emigrants. Enticements. It's hard to imagine all the thoughts going through the emigrants' heads as they headed for new countries. For most, once they left their home country, they would never see their family or friends again. Letter writing was the main source of communication. In some instances, families settled together in the same community. In their letters, many emigrants told of the good land available for farmers and encouraged hopes of succeeding in the U.S. when they could not in Germany or other European countries. Some letters included expressions from the Bible, such as Illinois being the land of milk and honey, new land given by the Lord. Europe was compared to Egypt, where people were servants and lived lives of hard labor. Promises were made of cheap land being available for hard-working settlers. Emigration fever started in the 1850s. Many people living in villages along the northern coast, which flooded with each major storm as these villages and farmland were below sea level. After the Christmas flood in 1717, the land was useless for the next several years as no crops could grow. Farm families were suffering through the weather, crop failures, and animal disease. About 90% of immigrants knew someone who had emigrated. German researchers used the term Kettenemigration, which refers to emigration having formed a chain. One immigrant brings the next through family relation or religious affiliation. Strong connections between families and the new founded settlements helped to start colonies in the New World. Some emigrants settled in areas where they knew others had settled because they spoke the same language or had the same religious beliefs and customs. Entering the United States during the 19th century, over 300 million Europeans migrated to the U.S., peaking between 1880 and 1914. Traveling to the U.S. across the Atlantic was no easy feat. Seasickness caused severe health problems, as did the lack of good food. The harsh, crowded steerage conditions on sailing ships, with trips lasting 40 to 90 days, were almost unbearable. Conditions would later improve with faster steamships. A bridge was built across the Mississippi River at Dubuque, and a rail line exited to Clarksville, Iowa. From Clarksville, land seekers went west through the Midwest, or they came into Illinois, Indiana, or Michigan. Many entered through New Orleans, which gave them access via riverboats north to areas where other family members settled. Most popular was Ellis Island, an island which actually protected emigrants from scammers. Once in the U.S., the American government didn't assist immigrants in acclimating to their new country. After passing a medical exam and demonstrating their ability to support themselves, they walked onto the docks, where most of them were left to fend for themselves. Dealing with difficulties was bad enough before and during the trip, but once on land, they had more to face. There were scammers and/or tricksters in the harbor. Language barriers led to misunderstandings. and young women traveling alone were vulnerable. German immigrants in New York City were supported by institutions such as the Leo House, a Catholic guest home in Chelsea, and the German Society of New York City, which helped newcomers. The Lower East Side was famously known as Klein Deutschland, Little Germany. Many of the institutions sent representatives to meet the ships and offer help. As mentioned above before, many arrived terribly homesick, but could never return. They brought their language, naming patterns, religious beliefs, and work ethics, all for the promise of a new life. Most settled in colonies with other immigrants who shared the same values, work ethics, traditions, and the German language. Major U.S. ports of the 5.4 million people who arrived in the U.S. between 1820 and 1860, more than two-thirds entered at New York. By the 1890s, more than 80% came through New York. Although New York was the largest and most important portal, there were more than 70 other federal immigration stations located along U.S. shores. Some of those ports were Baltimore, Philadelphia, New Orleans, and Galveston. New York's Castle Garden. In 1855, an old fort was designated as an immigrant station under supervision of the state of New York. When a new federal law passed in 1882, Castle Garden operated under contract to the U.S. government. Castle Garden was not large enough to cope with the daily arrival of immigrants. From April 1890 to December of 1891, a barge office near the U.S. Customs House at the front of Manhattan served as the immigrant station. On Ellis Island, the immigrants could be screened, protected, and filtered slowly into their new culture. On June 1st, 1892, the Ellis Island station was opened, but the wooden buildings burned on June 15th, 1897. Immigrants were again screened on barges until the new brick structures opened in 1900. German meal research suggestions. Tea ceremony following the initial program. The 25 in attendance enjoyed a meal consisting of German dishes. Served were Kartoffelsuppe, potato soup, grünen Bohnen mit Speck, green beans, Gemüsesuppe, vegetable soup, Brötchen, rolls, Schweineschnitzel, fried pork, Kartoffelgratin, scalloped potatoes, Kartoffelklasse, potato dumplings, Gebäck, German chocolate cake, Rippenbraten, beef tips, and Rotkohl, red cabbage. Strong gave several research ideas and sites where those who want to research their ancestors can go. If you can't find the port used by your ancestors, you may be able to find the route they used to the U.S. border. Crossing records for Canada and the U.S. are available for 1895 through 1956. Canadian passenger lists are available for 1865 through 1935. 1865 through 1935. There are 120 land points of entry between Canada and the U.S. Names of immigrants were not changed when they came to Ellis Island. Names were written by hand, so they may not be legible any longer. Women may have traveled using their maiden names. Other points which may be helpful in researching are age, occupation, or who they traveled with. Start your research using the name of the head of the family. If you know of other family members who traveled with them or arrived after them, use those names. Check obituaries, community history books, state and federal census records, naturalization records, and the town where each child was born. Following the portion of the program which covered research, a tea ceremony was enjoyed by those present. ICGS, more information. Mary Burr encourages those who would like to look into their ancestry to contact her at the ICGS office, which is located on the first floor of the old courthouse museum, 103 West Cherry, Watsika. Hours are 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Monday through Friday, and the number is 815-432-3730. You can also visit the group's website at www.IroquoisCountyGenealogy.org or send an email to IROQGENE@gmail.com. The group's Facebook page is Iroquois County Genealogical Society. District number 249, Board of Ed, sets fiscal year 27 meeting dates by Kim Rabe for the Times Republic. The Board of Education of Crescent, Iroquois, CUSD number 249, Board of Ed, conducted a meeting Monday, April 20th. Steve Massey, Board President, called the meeting to order at 6 p.m. and led the Pledge of Allegiance. Secretary Becky Dirks took roll call with the following members responding: Candy Butzo, Massey, Dirks, Lee Medina, and Mallory Redeker. Also present was Superintendent/Principal Lucas Schroeder. Arriving shortly after the meeting began were board members Tim Coleman and Aaron Hamilton. No changes were made to the agenda, so the board moved on to non-discussion items. Possible board meeting dates were shared, and the start time of meetings will remain at 6 p.m. Schroeder is finishing non-certified evaluations, and the policy committee needs to meet before the May 18th meeting. Per Schroeder's superintendent's report, he discussed the issue of insurance coverage for those mowing school grounds, the possible lack of a bus driver this week, the latest information he has on the county windmill project, and reminded members to get their statements of economic interest turned in before May 1st. For the principal's report, the following was shared. Enrollment stands at 51 for K through 5 students and 47 for grades 6 through 12. Rachel Bouchel has set a spring music concert for 1:30 p.m. Thursday, May 14th, with staff participating. Students will sing for the Bring Your Own Mug group prior to the concert. Two fifth graders will participate in the Iroquois County Administrators Association luncheon on May 6th. K through 2 students will have two excursions in May. There is no school Monday, May 25th, Memorial Day. The final reward for the Hawks Reading Challenge has been set for Friday, May 22nd, And the last day of school is Friday, May 29th, with an 11:30 a.m. dismissal. Students will not be served lunch. May 29th is also the district lunch at noon, and the board is invited. The board went on to approve the following items: minutes of the March 16th regular meeting, the treasurer's report dated March 31st, the payment of bills dated April 20th, the impressed fund and petty cash reports of March 31st, leaving closed minutes closed, destruction of audio tapes older than 18 months, having Lucy Veenrank as a volunteer cafeteria supervisor on an as-needed basis, and one FOIA request. Russell Lee and Associates were retained to perform the district's fiscal year 26 audit and the fiscal year 25 district financial report was approved. Meeting dates were set for the 2026-27 school year as follows. Monday, July 20th, 2026, the budget will be put on display August 17th, September 21st, October 26th, fourth Monday due to IPA conference, November 16th, December 21st, January 25th, 2027, fourth Monday due to Martin Luther King Jr. Day, February 22nd, 4th Monday due to President's Day, March 15th, April 19th, May 17th, and June 21st. All meetings will take place in the boardroom at 6 p.m. Registration fee for K through 5 students will be $30, and adult meals will cost $4 for the next school year. The consolidated district plan for fiscal year 27 was approved. The board then adjourned to an executive session to discuss the appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the district or legal counsel for the district, including hearing testimony on a complaint lodged against an employee or against legal counsel for the district to determine its validity. However, a meeting to consider an increase in compensation to a specific employee of a public body that is subject to the Local Government Wage Increase Transparency Act may not be closed and shall be open to the public and posted and held in accordance with this act amended. Once that session ended, the board reconvened and adjourned the regular meeting. The next meeting will be June 22nd at 6 p.m. in the CCGS boardroom. Watsika man charged with infant son's death. A Watsika man has been charged with first-degree murder and aggravated battery in the death of his one-month-old son. According to Iroquois County Sheriff's police reports, Jason L. Ruiz, 22, was arrested in Chicago by U.S. Marshal Great Lakes Fugitive Task Force April 16th. Police indicate that on April 10th, Watsika Fire and EMS were dispatched to 1631 North Bluebell Bend Road in rural Watsika in reference to a three-week-old baby not breathing. The infant, later identified as Jace, was transported from the scene to Iroquois Memorial Hospital and later to Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Jace was pronounced deceased on April 13th. The investigation remains active. Out of respect for the ongoing legal proceedings and the victim's family, police say no additional information will be released at this time. This has been Lincoln reading for you the Iroquois County Times-Republic for Thursday, April 23rd, 2026. Have a fabulous day.